There can be coarse language and adult concepts in our program, so please watch out for little ears that might be running around if you've got your podcast playing, or pop on some headphones, and that way no one can get offended but you.
And that's where we're at now. We're at this a terrible juncture where children are being handed over to a parent that they're terrified of. And once they're ordered into that parent's custody, even if they go to police and allege abuse and say that they need protection, the police have no power to protect them.
You're listening to the Rights for Women podcast, where we talk everything women and writing. I'm Kel Butler, podcaster and wannabe author.
And I'm Pamela Cook, author of four published books and a professional writing teacher. Together, we created the Rights for Women podcast to celebrate women writers and support women's rights.
We'll start with half an hour of chat with some brilliant female, trans or non-binary author. And whether you're a reader or a writer, you're going to love our chats on the Combo Couch this year.
In the second half hour, Kel and I will be chatting about the writing themes and challenges that resonated with us most out of the interview, both as women and as writers. So, if you are a woman writing,
or if you like women in writing,
if you like women who write,
or writing by women,
then the Rights for Women podcast is for you.
Listen to all of our episodes at www.rightsforwomen.com or subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your pods. Heya, welcome back to part two of our interview with Jess Hill about her book, See What You Made Me Do, a look at domestic abuse from the perspective of why does he do it instead of the always asked question, why didn't she leave? This is the second part of a two-part special. If you haven't listened to the first episode, just scroll back in the Rights for Women feed. It'll be the one before this one, and go and have a listen. Last week, we had a look at the different behaviours men display when they're being abusive, because it's not always obvious, and the way that abusive relationships can play out. This week, we're taking a deeper look at men's behaviour and what triggers it and what's actually underlying it all, especially men's anger. Patriarchy and the role it plays in everything, and the role of family law courts and the government. Just like last episode, this episode needs a trigger warning. So if you're somebody who thinks you may get triggered by this discussion about domestic abuse and men's violence, please don't listen to the episode. It's not worth it. We suggest you go and buy Jess's book and work through that at your own pace. If you do listen and get triggered at any point or come out of it thinking that you really need to talk to somebody, please call 1-800-RESPECT or Lifeline. Both of those services provide free, non-judgmental support for any gender and all age groups. Please do not hesitate to reach out if you need help. We have included all of the details for 1-800-RESPECT and Lifeline in the show notes. We hope that this episode shines a light on some of the things that are underpinning why women don't leave so easily and why men are doing this. Let's get straight into it.
The longer that a woman stays in that fog, you know, unaware of what's happening to her, maybe feeling a type of fear, uncertainty, a type of discombobulation, where they're kind of trapped in this state of almost like mental captivity, where they can't make head or tail of what's going on. The problem is not so much that, it's not that once she realizes she's being abused, well, she'll make the rational decision to leave, and then there's one pathway out of this. But it's important to realize the level of danger that she's in, and to make plans around how to best protect herself in that. Some women will decide that the best way to protect herself and maybe her children is actually to stay in the relationship, because they may be afraid of what might happen in family court if they leave. You know, there are lots of different rational decisions that women make in violent situations. It's very difficult to have any type of solid ground to make, you know, coherent decisions in that situation until maybe you get a little break,
yes,
from that person for some reason, or someone says something and it's like suddenly the fog clears, even just for a few minutes, and you see your situation for what it is. And you've got, there's an opportunity to do something different. But what you need at that moment usually is for someone, if you seek help, for someone to respond in a way that feels safe, in a way that feels like is going to work for the situation that you're in. And a lot of the time, women, when they get that moment of clarity, or maybe even a few days or a few weeks of clarity, they will reach out for help. And, you know, best case scenario, they'll get exactly what they need. But for a lot of women, they don't. They get maybe disbelieved, or they get a solution presented to them that doesn't work for them. You know, so, and at that point, they feel like maybe there's no one that can help me, and it's easier just to go back.
Or as you've pointed out in the book, which we'll go into further, but when you're talking about systemic failures, it's the fact that the accuser, the woman who's the accuser, the fact that she is accused on any level can actually be turned against her. And that,
yeah,
that,
absolutely.
That accuser, the woman who's desperately reached out to try and get some help and some solid ground, is finding there's absolutely nothing there.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, there's a, I start the chapter on the family law system with a quote from Fiona McCormack from DB Victoria. And it basically says that, you know, when there's a violent situation in a household, child protection may be called, and they'll say, if you can't protect your children from this abusive parent, we'll have to remove them from you. Then they leave, and the family court gets involved, and they say, if you can't help your children have a relationship with this parent, then we may remove your children from you. And it's this total double bind that women find themselves in, where it's if they say in the family court that they have experienced abuse and that abuse should preclude the abuser from having contact with their children, they run the risk of being labeled as what used to be called a hostile parent.
Yeah.
You know, that was actually in the legislation as brought in under reforms, the Howard reforms in 2006. They don't call it that so explicitly now, but it's still very much alive in the family law system as the way that judges will often interpret the behavior of women, that they're trying to stop their children having a relationship with their father purely because of their own hostility, not because there's a threat to their children. And that includes situations where there is a proven history of domestic violence and even violence against the children, and where the children themselves have gone to, you know, the individual that you just mentioned. There's an individual in a family law trial or a family law hearing who is called a single expert, who will do an assessment of the family. Usually goes for maybe 1 or 2 hours. They meet various members of the family. They put some of them together in a room and they watch the dynamics and they write a report on how that family interacts. That expert report writer may be the only qualification they may have is that they are a psychiatrist, not that they have any necessarily clinical experience with family violence or any training. And what they write is incredibly influential in the court and in terms of deciding who gets custody of those children. And I have heard case after case where children have gone into that room with that psychiatrist or psychologist or social worker who writes these reports, tells them what happened to them at the hands of that abusive parent, says they are absolutely terrified of even being in the same room as them, and they have been handed not just into the unsupervised care of that parent, but into the full-time custody and had their contact cut off for months at a time with the protective parent they felt safe with, who may actually be their primary caregiver. They may not have even had much contact with the other parent for months or years. Mm. I mean, so it really is a twisted system.
So that was probably one of the hardest chapters of your book to read and digest. That one took a while. I couldn't understand it, Jess. Like, A, talk to me about what John Howard was thinking. Talk to me about the change in laws and the premise that has been unfounded since talk to us about what happened and how that fundamentally changed any rights women had in family law.
So in 2006, the Howard reforms essentially introduced some new guiding principles for the family law courts. And essentially what they did was they prioritized shared parenting. They put a caveat that the child does not necessarily need to have a relationship with both parents if there's a history of violence. So basically the Howard reforms, they required judges to apply a presumption of shared parental responsibility, that basically every child had a right to a relationship with both parents. Now, the caveat they put in there was except where violence or abuse was an issue. But, and this is something that an actual family court judge, Richard Chisholm, called the victim's dilemma. The sting in the tail of that reform was that if a parent alleged abuse, they faced this new friendly parent provision, which said judges had to consider the willingness of each parent to support a close relationship between the child and the other parent. So that meant that's what I was talking about with hostile parents. It meant that parents who alleged abuse, and especially those who sought no contact orders in terms of, you know, cutting off contact altogether between the children and the other parent, could be assessed as hostile parents, and that could see them lose custody of their children. Now, the situation that had, I guess, what had brought the family law courts to that point was a virulent campaign by fathers' rights groups that had been running since the 1980s, which talked about basically that the family law courts was a weapon in the feminist armory against fathers, and that it was working on behalf of mothers to shut fathers out of children's lives. You know, if you think about what the family law courts did, it makes a lot of sense why fathers' rights groups appeared and were so virulent as they were. Because when the family law court was established in 1975, it basically, you know, it established no-fault divorce. What did that mean? It meant that women could leave relationships, and particularly abusive relationships, without having to go through an embarrassing, possibly public trial with all of the worst things in their relationships sort of laid before a public system. Basically, it meant that they could go to the court, they could ask for a divorce, and they did not even need to have a reason. No one needed to be at fault. No one needed to have cheated. Mm-hmm. There didn't need to be anything about being deserted. So, and at that very same time, almost the exact same year, the first women's shelters were established in Australia. So not only did you have a legal system that was now allowing women to leave, you had houses they could flee to. So women who otherwise would not have been able to leave abusive partners, or who would otherwise have just stayed in unhappy marriages, left in droves. So you have a bunch of men who are used to having a lot more control over the women in their marriages, losing a major part of that control and over that sense of I have control over what happens in my own home. So it was pretty soon after the family law courts were established that the fathers' rights groups started up, and they campaigned very hard. Then you had a series of assassinations of family law court judges and bombings, like an actual bombing of the family law court in Parramatta, which we now know, you know, was, we now have a man who's been charged with this, who was losing custody of his child, who had a history of violence, right? But at the time, the fathers' rights groups were so effective that the media was reporting it as though, well, the family law court must have done something to bring this upon itself by being, you know, the subtext was by being aligned too closely with the needs and desires of women. You know,
that's ever happened before.
Right. And all the research at the time, because the family law court took it seriously. So they did some research into like, well, are we making decisions that are discriminating against fathers? And several research studies show that actually, in terms of when a case went to trial, the results were equal or favorable to the father. But a lot of fathers were actually giving away their parenting rights by consent, because at the time, the majority of the parenting was being done by mothers. You know, I mean, that's still quite, you know, similar situation now, but back then even more so. So in reality, what the fathers' rights groups were saying was not true, but they had an incredible amount of influence in the federal government, and the federal government has jurisdiction over the family law courts. It was an incessant and intimidating campaign, and that's what led to the Howard reforms. And essentially what the Howard reforms did was, I guess, make what was already a cultural sort of bent against mothers alleging abuse, it embedded it into the legislation that judges needed to abide by. Now, in the years since, the Gillard government in 2012 overturned the Howard reforms. They made the consideration of violence a much more pressing issue for judges. But to my mind, the damage has already been done. And culturally, the family law court has an enormous problem with understanding domestic violence or seeing it as an issue that is not only harmful to the parent, the abused parent, but to the children. And it's not a historical issue, but this is something that the children have experienced in a very different way to their victimized parent, but in a way that's no less harmful. And that's where we're at now. We're at this in terrible juncture where children are being handed over to a parent that they're terrified of. And once they're ordered into that parent's custody, even if they go to police and allege abuse and say that they need protection, the police have no power to protect them because they do not have any jurisdiction over family law court orders, and they will actually return those children to the parent they say is abusing them. That's the situation we're in now.
It's devastating. So here's my question for you, Jess. Here's my question, actually, for our country. When these children grow up, is our government going to have a case to answer for what they've done to them? Will they have a right to stand up and say, we want a royal commission into the decision you made for us to put us back into the hands of someone who was sexually abusing me, who was physically abusing me, who was emotionally and mentally abusing me every single day, for the fact that I have family members who now abuse others, for the fact that I have family members who are dead from suicide, from the fact that I now cannot exist in the world and function because you made a choice and did not listen to me or the person who was trying to protect me. Do you think there will be a case to answer one day to that Howard government?
I think there already is a case to answer. And I think, you know, we've seen calls from Hetty Johnston, the founder and director of Bravehearts, from Rosie Batty, from Women's Legal Services, all calling for a royal commission. And that's what's required because, you know, the problem with the family law courts, and it's the genesis of the problem, is actually, it was actually in caring for children and their privacy, which was to make it basically very difficult for parents to speak publicly about what happened during a family law court hearing. So any party to a proceeding could not be identified because they wanted to, you know, get around any vindictive parents sort of, you know, publishing things that would then go on to hurt the children later on. What that's morphed into, though, is a very secretive system in which nobody can be held accountable. So those single experts, for example, who write the reports that are very influential in the courts, they have expert immunity. They can't be named for the work that they do. It's very difficult to even get permission to read the reports that they write. So this level of secrecy that surrounds the family law courts makes it very difficult for any other body apart from the extraordinary powers of a royal commission to really investigate. And that's why people are calling for something that, you know, that extreme, because they feel like the only way we're going to get to the bottom of what is going on in this system is through those extraordinary investigative powers. Now, you know, one boy that I interviewed when he was 14, he'd been sent into the care of his abusive father when he was 3 or 4. His mother had seen signs of child sexual abuse. There'd been domestic violence, severe domestic violence. there'd been two previous wives who had also alleged child sexual abuse on the record. And the judge in this hearing had dismissed that and had handed the boy to the father, into the sole custody of the father, and had actually cut off contact between the very little boy and his mother for several months, and made it so that the mother had to have her contact supervised professionally as though she was the danger. When the boy who I call Alex in the book got old enough to feel like he might be able to do something about the situation he was in, he had lived through a childhood where physical abuse was so common it was unremarkable, where he could be cleaning his teeth and his father would come up to him and slap him for absolutely no reason, no provocation. I mean, this was the sort of thing that just happened to him day in, day out. He decided to run away and run away to the police to beg for help. So he went to the police. He explained what was happening. They found out that his father had sole custody of him. They called his father and got his father to come and collect him from the police station. Alex ran away again to the police with his brother this time. Same thing happened. The third time he ran away, he made sure he had some physical evidence. When he got to the police station, he showed them physical evidence of the abuse. Finally, they believed him and thought this is something that they have to step out of their usual relationship with family court orders and do something extraordinary. He was on the floor of that police station shaking and crying as he talked about what had happened to him over those years of living with his father. Long story cut short, Alex, at age 14, was finally allowed to go back and live with his mother. When I interviewed him, he was actually providing moral support for other children who were at risk or who were being about to be handed back into the custody of a parent they were terrified of. He would talk to them on the phone. He would even go around to their house and talk to them about how not to give up hope, what to do, and how to cope with being separate from their protective parent. And he was starting a campaign to get more and more people aware of what was happening in the family court. And he said to me that the reason why he was doing that was to make sure that no other child had to go through what he went through. Now, when I went and checked in on him 4 years later, which is when I was about to put the book to print because I was republishing his story and I wanted to see what had happened in the years since, his mother told me that he hadn't been able to finish school and that he was unable to work because he'd been diagnosed with a type of PTSD that was so severe that he couldn't study or work and that he was now having to apply for the disability support pension. So that was a lifetime of abuse that was, in my estimation, facilitated by the family law system, where there was evidence, plenty of evidence to suggest that the safest course of action was to keep that boy with his mother. And yet he was handed into the sole custody of a parent that terrified him. And when he ran away and the family court was called in again to reassess him, the psychiatrist who was brought in to write an assessment of the situation for the judge made the assessment that Alex was suicidal because he was seeking attention, that he was not actually being abused, and that the best way for him to reform a relationship with his father was to again be entirely cut off from contact with his mother, and that furthermore, if he was to try to run away again to police, the mother should be incarcerated. Like that's actually written in a report that was handed to a judge. You know, and the result of that was that he was handed back to the father for a period of time and then went back to the police, et cetera, and did eventually end up back in the care of his mother. But that's, you know, that's the kind of thing that we're seeing, the kind of warped ideology that is informing way too many of these so-called expert reports and is persuading judges to make decisions about the care of children that is so dangerous to the point where it's life-threatening for these children, and in ways that these decisions are not being reviewed at any time to see how the children are going. It's just something that becomes set in stone, and the only way that you can try to change that as a parent is if you spend the money and appeal and continue to fight through the family law courts, which can cost tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars.
So it sounds like our government has a lot to answer for the generations of children coming through. And it's reminding me a lot of the stolen generations. It's reminding me a lot as well as what we've uncovered in the churches, where adults and people of authority are making decisions and assessments based on ignorance, pure ignorance.
And worse. And worse, you know, because ignorance would be almost understandable. That's right. You know, you have judges who are looking at histories of incredible domestic violence and dismissing it. Or you even have, you know, who was for a time controversially the Supreme Court judge of Queensland, Carmody, Justice Carmody, saying that essentially even if a father sexually abuses his child, that should not prohibit that father from having a relationship with the child. That's the type of ideology that is astonishing.
So I think this is why we need a Royal Commission into the family law courts, into all of it, because this really does seem like just an insidious disease that's happening from the minute someone tries to get help. And no wonder women aren't getting help. People say, as you said, you wrote a book that is, why does he do this, instead of why does she stay? But that question of why does she stay? Well, if that's what you're looking at and your kids are looking at, if you try to leave, what other choices do you have, because you aren't being supported by the legal system as a victim and survivor? You are being blamed, just like you may, it's like an extension of the abuse.
Well, that's right. And that's how women experience it. Certainly you have children who are growing up with, you know, incredible attachment disorders and, I don't know, becoming addicted to substances, who are living lives where they are terrified of themselves, of what they might turn out to be. You know, I've spoken to so many grown male survivors of childhood domestic violence who said that they were terrified that they would go on to become their father. And actually almost didn't want to go into relationships and didn't want to have children because they saw it almost as an inevitability. So the damage that is wrought on children through domestic violence is just unspeakable. It's enormous, not to mention the level of complex trauma that these children are dealing with throughout their lives and the sorts of physical illnesses. What we know when children go through a traumatic childhood, especially where there is abuse involved, that can often in adulthood lead to an increase in physical disorders, physical illnesses. Mm. You know, this is what we're dealing with. We're creating a society which is at its core dysfunctional.
And sick.
Because the home, and sick, and because the home is supposed to be the place where you develop that sense of security and trust. And if you grow up having that sense of trust betrayed at the most fundamental levels, rebuilding a sense of trust with the universe is incredibly difficult. It becomes an intellectual exercise, because in your heart, as a child, you learned that it wasn't safe to trust anyone. It was safer not to trust people.
And so on this level, how do we fix that? Is that what we need? Do we need someone to step up and have the ball? I don't see it happening with a Scott Morrison government, but or a Liberal government. But is it up to somebody to step up and say, yeah, we really need a Royal Commission here. We need to overhaul this entire system. And what about maybe making sure there are some barometers for the experts, making sure they're trained in domestic violence? What about applying some of the coercive control rules that have passed in the UK, the stalking laws that have passed?
Yeah, and this is the thing. So, I mean, in terms of the family law courts, like when you have an expert write a report with an understanding of the dynamics of what's going on, the report they write is accurate and it gives the judge good information. When you have someone who either doesn't understand or doesn't want to understand or has a type of sympathy for perpetrators in these situations, then you have the opposite. So I think it's absolutely urgent to have a better standard for what the court accepts as expert testimony, especially for custody hearings that involve family violence. On the level of what do we do as a society, you know, we have made incredible inroads into public health issues that looked utterly intractable because we decided to prioritize it. So when the government decided to prioritize anti-smoking, for example.
Yes.
You know, they brought about a suite of measures using a proven approach, which is a public health approach, where you look at three different categories: primary prevention, tertiary prevention, and secondary prevention. What that basically means is you've got behavioural and attitude change through advertising campaigns and those sorts of things, and education. You have interventions on the level of trying to change people, like trying to help people who are addicted and all the rest of it. And then you have at the bottom end trying to stop people from getting cigarettes in the first place. Now, the fact they did all three levels of that public health campaign were pursued vigorously. They had particular targets for what kind of reduction they wanted to see in tobacco use. And they did things like increase the excise on cigarette packets so they're not so affordable. They did incredibly radical things like the Gillard government did in introducing plain packaging legislation.
That was a huge win. That was a big fight.
A big fight. You know, they were taken to international arbitration courts by Philip Morris, and it was potentially hundreds of millions of dollars at stake. But they pursued it because they knew that it was the right thing to do, and they knew that if they made it so that individuals could not have their favorite brands, that they were all just going to have a drab olive green packet with, you know, horrific pictures of what might happen to them if they continue to smoke on them, that was a proven deterrent to smokers. Mm. But they did all of these things in concert. And because they started, I believe, because they started with a target of what they wanted to see and they knew what they wanted to see as a result, they then had to do the necessary things to get there.
Okay, so...
I mean, the same...
But...
Yeah, go on.
When you keep talking about governmental change, I'm noticing a pattern here. So it's a Labor government that starts the policies to try and help family law and women and children, and not just women, anyone in that situation, because you can't cut out violence against men, which does happen. You can't cut out LGBTQI+ community. It's everybody. And they open the door to start helping. Howard government comes in and closes that door. Gillard government starts to try and open it again. Now we're back into another Liberal government. Now, smoking's one thing. There's no gender attached to smoking.
Mm. But there is corporate power.
But there's gender attached to family law. So the men's rights groups came in, and because they align with a particular vision, a patriarchal vision that the Liberal government would like Australia to adhere to, they move towards that direction. This is being based on the thing that has created all of this in the first place, patriarchy. Should we talk about the role of patriarchy in all of this?
Yeah, so you know, patriarchy is certainly something that, I mean, we see writ large across our society. It is the basically, it's one of the main frames that governs the way that we live. And for a very long time, patriarchy as a concept and as a structural environment has been largely invisible, you know, except to sort of radical feminists back in the 1970s, who I guess really popularized the term, but it was still quite an extreme idea. And even to the point where when I first started writing the book in 2016, I thought that if I mention patriarchy explicitly and start to explore it, that I'll be pegged as some anti-male activist, you know, because it had such extreme connotations. Mm. But what we had with the Me Too movement, when that went viral in 2017, suddenly, because we need to start asking, well, how is this going on? How is it going on at such an enormous scale? We needed to start looking at what is the system in which we live. Now, the system in which we live is patriarchy. And that's the way, that is the key to us understanding why these behaviors persist. Just so happened, people were so desperate to understand that suddenly we started to talk about patriarchy as though it was just some everyday concept. So suddenly I was in a situation where I'm halfway through the book and I'm like, well, look, if I don't talk about patriarchy explicitly, I'm going to get hammered, you know? So it went from one extreme to the other, which was excellent because I knew that the way we were talking about domestic abuse and the systems that respond to it, to say that the roots of the problem go to gender inequality did not go anywhere near, to my mind, explaining what we were seeing in terms of men's behavior. So I felt it was very, very important to really interrogate the parameters of patriarchy and look at the conditions that are created under that system. So, yeah.
Because it's actually, your chapter opens with a paragraph. And do you mind if I read that? Because I think you sum it up so beautifully. So there's a whole chapter in the book called Patriarchy. And first off, I think what you do as well is make patriarchy genderless in that it affects all genders. Yeah, patriarchy is doing just as much a disservice to men as it is to women. And I think it's seen when women talk about patriarchy as this, oh, it's all men are bad. But it's actually women now you talking about patriarchy, just like you in your book, in terms of a system that has created what is driving all of this violence and anger and control. And also driving the lack of support underpinning it all. And I think to be able to connect it to this one pinnacle is so fundamental. And you start the chapter by going, patriarchy is an invisible mainframe that regulates how we live. It sets parameters around acceptable behavior for both genders. Men should be strong, independent, unemotional, logical, and confident. And women should be expressive, nurturant, weak, and dependent. This artificial construct, which we mistake as natural, also renders various injustices unavoidable. The violence of men, the domestic servitude of women, the dominance of men in power, and so on. Under patriarchy, this is all unfortunate, but normal, natural, invisible. Sorry for interrupting you.
No, not at all. Yeah, so that's right. I mean, until now, it was, you know, and the Me Too movement blasted a lot of that apart because that whole idea of like, oh, well, sexual harassment is just a bit of an unfortunate fact of life. Suddenly women were like, no, it shouldn't be an unfortunate fact of life. In fact, it's actually causing me to lead a far diminished life professionally, personally, you know, that we shouldn't just accept this, which is why we've had to dig deeper and find out, well, why is this going on? So patriarchy, I think it's important to understand it like this. Essentially, it's a system that has two major flanks and at its core, another concept which we'll talk about in a second. Patriarchy is about men's power over women. That's the part that we talk about most often. And it's about the fact that maleness is privileged over femaleness. It is centered. It is given more attention in society, and that men feel like they should be dominant over women. And there's a sense of entitlement to women's bodies and so on. The other part of patriarchy that we don't talk about so often is some men's power over other men. And that's really, when I first was told that by Michael Kimmel, who's a masculinities expert, that made sense of so much to me. Because basically what that describes is a system by which male behavior is policed by other men, and the control and violence and fear instilled in them by other men. And that means that you're not just looking at a whole society of men who feel powerful because they've got one up on women. You've got a whole bunch of men who feel like they are at the whim of the control of other men and therefore feel vulnerable and at sometimes powerless, even though on the surface they may look powerful and privileged, they themselves can feel powerless. And so when women in the feminist movement talks about men as being powerful and privileged, you have men sort of really buckling at that and saying, no, you know, I'm not privileged. I'm not in control of my life. It's my boss. It's the wife. It's my children. Mm. They're all in control of me. But the essence of patriarchal masculinity is not that they feel powerful or that they are privileged. Is that they feel that they should be powerful.
Yes.
And it's when you get that sort of thwarted entitlement and when you have men who really expect that and have that overblown sense of entitlement to a type of power, and what a corollary to that, which is often an incredibly immature and, you know, undeveloped way of connecting through intimacy, then you have this, that's the sort of conditions that create domestic abuse and violence. And so I think that really, and at the heart of patriarchy, I should say, at the very core of patriarchy as the driving concept is control. It's dominion. It's dominion over nature. It's control over technology. It's control. Control is the highest concept under patriarchy. And women may decide that they align, they want to align with the powerful forces in society, and so they make control their utmost aim as well. It's not just something that men necessarily do. Men just have greater access to accessing that control. But if you've got that, those two sides, and control being the ultimate expression of patriarchy, men feel an incredible amount of pressure to show that they are in control, that they're abiding by the rules of patriarchy, that they're succeeding. Now, where does control unravel? In intimate relationships, because you can't be in control. Intimacy does to us what no other circumstance does, what no other relationship does, not one with our boss, not one with our friends or family. It exposes us. It runs us raw. The whole way of becoming intimate is through exposure. Fundamentally, if you feel like that, when you're vulnerable or exposed, that you feel powerless, and if you have that as a sense of shame because it's a type of compromised masculinity for men who really identify very closely with being in control, there are various ways that a man who's in that sort of really tightly controlled version of masculinity might respond. They might button up, never tell anyone about it, and just carry on in their own personal pain, you know, and never talk about it. Or they might decide that they shouldn't have to feel vulnerable. They shouldn't have to feel exposed. And how dare their partner make them feel like that? And in fact, you know what? To make sure that never happens again, I'm going to take control of this situation. And every time they feel that sense of shame and compromised masculinity, i.e. the sense of vulnerability that comes to all of us in intimate relationships, when it doesn't give them what they're expecting, which is some fantasized idea of what a relationship should be, then they respond with abuse, degradation, threats, or violence. So, and the And the entire purpose of that is to replace that unbearable feeling of shame, that feeling that makes you feel that you are bad, unlovable, unworthy, with a sense of power. Mm. And power is the opposite to shame. Power is pride, especially for a man. So that's the sort of, that's the kind of two-step that we're looking at with abusive men that I don't think we talk about enough, is the fact that, I mean, we saw in a study in New South Wales, there were 24 abusive men who were asked to describe how they feel before they exert violence or control over their partners. And they said in the moments before that happens, first they felt vulnerable, then they felt scared, and then they felt angry.
Mm.
And this is what we're seeing with a lot of abusive guys. They see themselves as the victim because they feel like they're being attacked, because they feel powerless. They feel like they're being reduced, even though there's possibly nothing that's happened to make them feel like that, nothing untoward, except something that they've perceived as compromising their strength or their control. And they feel like they need to take back control. And I think, you know, men's insecurity is writ large across our society because, you know, a lot of them have been raised by men, by fathers, who have raised them to believe that they'll never be good enough. They'll never be enough of a man. You know, that is the experience of just so many men. And they're not necessarily all going to turn into abusive men themselves, but it's a struggle that they live with their entire life. And the other condition that is likely to create an abusive man is a cold, rejecting mother.
Mm.
And you see it in a lot of guys. They talk about growing up with a mother that rejected them, or situations they felt like they were always undermined or made to feel less than. Now, for boys, when they grow up with a shaming father, as I said, they may not end up being abusive themselves, but there becomes this sort of pool of shame that they can't find any expression for, right? They grow up sort of fixing a mask because they need to wear this mask because they feel like internally they are utterly unlovable, they're unworthy, so they need to create and project an identity. So it might be that they're the tough guy or they're the cool guy or they're a gentleman or they're an environmental, you know, warrior, or they're any type, you know, any number of different masks that they might wear. Now, they can keep that mask pretty firmly fixed with their friends, even with their family, co-workers, but when they get into an intimate relationship, the woman they're with, if it's a heterosexual relationship, threatens basically to go behind that mask and see him for who he really is and expose part of him that he is so carefully hidden over the years. So instead of having what he may have thought of as an idealized kind of relationship where the woman is going to care for him and is going to provide all those things that he feels he needs because he was robbed of them in childhood, he starts to see that actually there's a lot expected of him in these intimate relationships. And then he starts to feel this kind of underlying rage, and it might just be irritation at first, but it starts to overwhelm him. And actually at first he might be totally shocked by it. He may feel absolutely mortified, apologetic, and feel a sense of shame that he's responded to this person that he loves in that way. But over time, if he keeps on going back to that same behavior, it becomes too difficult to keep apologizing and taking the blame because he doesn't want to stay in that place. He wants to feel powerful. That's the whole point of the mask he's created. So if it happens repeatedly, he starts to blame it on her. Mm-hmm. Then maybe if that relationship doesn't go so well, maybe he goes into another relationship and the same pattern happens. And over time, it's not just her, it's women in general. And then you get this sort of evolving misogyny. And at that point, you've got a man who is a serial abuser and no woman will be able to fix him. The only way he'll be able to fix himself is to realize the pattern that he's reproducing and to go back to the roots of why he's doing it and to look at his own sense of overblown entitlement, why he feels entitled
to impose that on the people that he loves and to do a lot of work on himself to overcome it.
So if that's what an abuser needs to do to be able to start overcoming it, what have we provided in our society for men to be able to go and seek behavioural change? I know you mentioned a couple of programs I'm really impressed with. Is it Kylie Dowse? How you pronounce the name?
Yeah.
Her men's behavioural program where she removes shame from the room and makes shame a narrative and a character. Now, imagine, I was reading that. Imagine if we did that in schools with teenage boys. And we made that just a part of the curriculum, a part of their emotional health education. Imagine if we gave them those tools at the age of 13 or 14 when they're evolving all of this stuff.
Yeah, because, you know, one of the key things that teenage boys and men are afraid of is being rejected, of being shamed, you know, and that plays a lot of issues around consent, around sex, around, you know, what their what the sort of treatment they should get in relationships, the sensitivity to having their opinions challenged or their worldview or women just having a different opinion to theirs. That's the sort of conversations we need to have in schools, because to just say you shouldn't be violent, well, everyone knows that. Of course you shouldn't be violent. No one says that you should be violent. That's not what society teaches children. But what society does teach young boys is that if they want to get the girl, if they want to make the money, if they want to succeed, they need to be in control. And if a woman is undermining their opinion or is rejecting them, well, they're not in control, are they? You know? So these are the sorts of concepts that unfortunately we need to be challenging in school, but we need to be really grappling with the society, because it's one thing to say to young boys, you need to look at these, you know, this in yourself. But what happens when they go out into the world and they just see those same things reinforced?
Exactly.
You know, it's very hard to maintain your own sense of resistance to that. I guess what we're looking at, you know, a lot of the reason why you have fathers shaming their sons or mothers rejecting their children is because of intergenerational trauma that they've not been able to deal with, is because of punitive systems like Centrelink and the way that it deals with people. You know, there's a number of things, I guess, in our society that generates this type of dysfunction. You know, I think we need to come to terms with the multi-generational trauma that affects not only, and to the most extreme point, Indigenous people in this country, but all of us.
Yeah.
All of us are dealing with the intergenerational trauma of several generations of fathers who went to war. Some of us come from migrant families who were refugees from wars in their own countries. You know, we have an extremely high number of refugee, high refugee populations. We have the highest number of Holocaust survivors outside of Israel.
Wow, I did not know that.
We have people who fled from Lebanon during the Civil War. We have people who fled Vietnam. We have people who fled from Greece during the Civil War after World War II. So we have an enormous backlog of intergenerational trauma in this country that we don't acknowledge. And really, I think as Judy Atkinson says, who's an Indigenous professor who specialises in this, under anger is grief.
Yeah.
And that's what we're dealing with, and we're starting to understand as a society, is the level of grief that is embedded in our society and the amount of dysfunction that grief causes. So I think really we need to start getting back to those roots, not so much teaching people how to be or not to be, but teaching people how to be with themselves.
Yes. Yeah.
How to bring them back to themselves, how to bring them back to their emotional core, how to make them feel comfortable with who they are. You know, and that's, I mean, how you do that on a society-wide project, I don't know. But certainly that's where we're at in the 21st century, is confronting this backlog of trauma and the incredible amount of damage that it continues to wreak across society.
you have the problem. You're trying to change it on a systemic level, but at the same time, every single day, it's affecting people and it's creating more trauma and more pathways of trauma. And kids are constantly being put back with their abusers, and women are not in a situation to leave because so many factors. And it's funny though, when you talk about on a societal level, it seems insurmountable, but I think your book makes it really obvious that it's not, in that I think if we could get a government that could do exactly what you said with tobacco and cigarettes and see it in that light and take the gender out of it and just go on a health level, the health issues this creates, as you said, not just physical health, mental health, emotional health, ongoing health, suicide prevention. There's huge gains to dealing with this situation for our society.
That's right. Except for governments who maybe don't achieve the targets that they set out to achieve and therefore fail. I mean, that's when you look at the sort of quid pro quo for governments, they don't want to set out to do something that they feel like they're going to fail.
Isn't any reduction on something like this a win? Isn't just any movement, no movement is a fail? How is how are you winning when you do nothing?
Well, because you don't have any target that someone said. You said you'd do this by 2020 and you didn't. So at the moment, our national plan doesn't have any targets in it. So they can't say, we said we would reduce domestic homicide by 10%, but we haven't done that. All they can say is we're still working on these, you know, long generational change programs to try and reduce domestic abuse and homicide, but, you know, the work continues.
I feel like the answers to it are multi-pronged. There needs to be a federal element that is dealing with this at the same level that they dealt with tobacco. There needs to be a royal commission into what our government up till now has actually done to generations of adults and children by the decisions they've made and enforced. And there needs to be some kind of acknowledgement of that. There also needs to be investment into men's behaviour programs similar to people like Kylie Dowse's programs. I recommend everybody go on YouTube and just have a listen to her, you know.
Yeah, these honest, really honest and raw and difficult conversations, you know, where it's not just about respect in relationship, but it's about what are you feeling? How do you name what you're feeling? Because a lot of opt-in to men who can't name their emotions. You know, that's a huge part of why I set out to write the book and why I spent so long writing it, to try to get that part right. Because I just had the sense that it was just a skeleton key to so much, you know, truth and understanding that was just waiting for people to access.
Jess, what are your final takeaways that you would like everyone to take away from today's chat?
I think what I want people to take away is that change is possible, both personally and on a nationwide scale.
Thank you so much, Jess. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, that's a wrap for this week. We'll catch you again next week. Thank you for popping us in your ears. We know that people don't have a lot of time nowadays, and the fact that you take the time to listen to us means a lot. If you like this episode and you want to catch a whole lot of the other Rights for Women episodes that we've done, head on over to our website on www.rightsforwomen.com, or hit up our Facebook page at Rights for Women, or you can catch us on Twitter and Instagram at W4WPodcast. Until next time, always choose kindness. This ep was produced and edited by Kel Butler from Listen Up Podcasting. Positive podcasts for a positive world.